And right now, since the so-called ceasefire, we don't take comfort about the fact that lives are being lost both in Gaza and also on the West Bank as we talk.
And as we talk about hunger, I want to move to Sudan in this last minute we have. If you can talk about the humanitarian catastrophe in Sudan and your continent of Africa.
So I think it's important to recognize the 12 million people, firstly, have been displaced. 12 million. Most countries in the world don't have 12 million population. Secondly, what has recently happened in Darfur? The numbers are not clear, but people are talking about bodies everywhere. Absolute massacration.
Ravaging
through. We're talking about, people are talking about tens of thousands of people. I don't want to commit to that figure because there's a news blackout, but there is every reason to believe that that's happening. And let me just say, the global media has been pathetically complicit in their silence by just ignoring this. And that's why many people in Africa are now saying this is not just a problem with mainstream media, this is also a problem with white stream media, in the sense that black lives don't really seem to happen. If this was happening in North America or Europe, I mean, the whole world would be seeing saturation coverage. We need RSF and the previous army to comply to a negotiation process to stop this immediately. And the UN and the international community must raise the visibility and the energy in addressing this, because history will judge this as bad as we judged Rwanda at the end of the day.
I want to thank you, Kumi Naidoo, for being with us, South African human rights environmental justice activist, president of the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty Initiative, former head of Greenpeace International, Amnesty International. Happy birthday to Ivanine Kapie. Thank you to Tarina Nadura, Dennis Moynihan, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, and Sam Alkoff, who are here on the ground with us in Belém, Brazil, at the UN COP 30. I'm Amy Goodman.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. Make sure to tune in on Wednesday, November 26th from 6 to 7 p.m. to vote for the president of the Youth Collective. We want this to be an unbiased, fair election, and that's why we need you to vote. But really, you should be biased. Biased towards me. Why? Well, we have my dear radio teacher, Jacob, here to tell you why you should vote for me.
Well, pretty much the greatest student in the history of existence. GPA is 100,000% out of 4. How dare you vote for anybody else?
That is why you should vote for me, Elizabeth, for President of the Youth Collective. Thank you so much, and make sure to tune back in on November 26th, 6 to 7 p.m. to vote for me.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up in the KBOO Evening News, federal immigration officials report their arrest numbers for October in Portland far higher than advocates knew about.
Portland City Council mulls a fee for detention facilities and a ban for AI rental price fixing.
And in international news, an incarcerated man in Australia is suing the prison system for denying access to, wait for it, Vegemite.
Good evening. This is KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, November 18th, 2025. I'm Danny Shy.
And I'm Dave Johnson. Federal immigration officials say they arrested over 560 people in the Portland area, a big jump from the 300 or so estimated across the state by the Portland Immigration Rights Coalition. Many of these arrests have been without warrants and done violently. masked, unidentified, and armed agents have been terrorizing Latino communities in Oregon in particular. Federal officials have also taken to arresting anyone else they come across in these raids, including U.S. citizens and people with legal residency. Data from the Migration Policy Institute found that nearly three-quarters of those held by ICE nationally in September didn't have any criminal charges against them. When they did, it was usually minor offenses like a traffic ticket. The volunteer-led group, Portland Immigration Rights Coalition, runs a hotline for people to report ICE sightings and to help connect those detained with legal help. The group also runs free ICE Watch trainings for community members.
Portland City Council will consider an ordinance that would create a new fee for landlords who rent their property out as a detention facility. If that sounds like a certain ICE facility on the South Waterfront, it would fall under the new ordinance. Government-owned detention facilities would be exempt. City Councilor Angelita Murillo put the fee forward as a way for the city to recoup some costs that come from the facility being in the city, namely the environmental impact on the surrounding neighborhood and the police resources dedicated to a site of protest activity. The group Portland Contra Las Deportaciones is opposing the ordinance and planning a rally outside City Hall at 5 tomorrow. They say the fee is, quote, performative, and call on City Council to revoke the ICE facility's permit. Portland has issued a land use violation notice to the detention facility more than 60 days ago, which the landlord is appealing. Written testimony on the detention facility fee is mixed so far, with the support of some and some opposition.
Portland City Council is poised to vote on a ban on using AI algorithms to set rental prices in the city. The proposal would ban the use of this type of price fixing. Oregon is party to a federal lawsuit against one service like this, RealPage. The suit alleges that the company, like RealPage, aggregate data from hundreds of large landlords and suggest rental pricing, inflating the price of the rental market. It's even alleged that they will recommend that landlords and property managers leave units empty in order to inflate the value of the units. It was first brought forward by Councilor Angelita Murillo earlier this year and was tabled in the spring while the proposal was retooled. Murillo hopes to avoid a lawsuit against the ban from industry groups like the one Berkeley, California is wrapped up in. Proponents of the ban say it will help lower rents and it won't hurt small landlords, since you have to own a lot of properties to even qualify to use the services. The industry groups have pushed back, saying it will push away developers. Portland City Council meets on 6 p.m. on Wednesday.
The public comment period to rescind the public lands rule has closed after garnering over 150,000 comments, almost all of which were in support of keeping the rule. It was finalized last year. Proponents say the rule would help the Bureau of Land Management balance conservation with natural resource development. Isabel Charlet reports.
The Trump administration is planning to rescind the public lands rule, which proponents say would help the Bureau of Land Management restore landscapes, plan for responsible development, and protect cultural and natural resources. A comment period for the rescission of the rule garnered more than 150,000 comments, almost all of which were in favor of keeping it. Mark Salvo is with the Oregon Natural Desert Association. He says at a time when invasive species, wildfire, climate change, and other existential threats loom over the state's southeastern public lands, revoking the rule would be a missed opportunity.
This rule could have been, still could be, really important to not only those lands, wildlife, and watersheds in eastern Oregon, but for the multitude of recreationists, communities, regional economies that depend on those resources.
The BLM manages nearly 15 million acres of public land in Oregon, largely east of the Cascades. Salvo says his organization is part of a coalition coalition of sporting groups, tribes, local businesses, and local jurisdictions who are all in support of the new regulation. It is unknown when the final decision whether to rescind the rule will be made. Opponents argue the public lands rule would limit grazing and resource extraction by prioritizing conservation while hindering local control over public land. But Salvo argues it would allow local communities to engage more directly with the BLM to restore public lands. He adds the rule is essential for the Bureau to fulfill its 50-year-old mandate to balance conservation with other uses.
There was never any proven concern that development would somehow be curtailed just because we were also ensuring that conservation and restoration would be treated as a co-equal multiple use on those landscapes.
While the high deserts of eastern Oregon may be taking a blow from the federal level, Salvo says he is inspired by the care for the land that local communities and state leadership continue to show.
The number of people and the resources and their commitment to addressing these problems is impressive and increasing over time.
A coalition of 61 members of Congress and over 180 local officials from every Western state joined public comments opposing the rule's rescission. For Public News Service, I'm Isabel Charlet.
The federal government's free tax tool, the IRS Direct File Program, is no more. That means nearly $600 million in yearly savings is vanishing from states. Crystal Blair has the details.
The tool created under the Inflation Reduction Act offered free, simplified tax filing for people earning roughly $100,000 to $120,000 or less. Adam Rubin, vice president at the Economic Security Project, says the savings weren't small and the program had the potential to put billions back into families' pockets.
It could save existing tax filers $8 billion in filing fees, an additional $3 billion in time saved, and it could help people who are missing out on tax credits claim an additional $12 billion more.
Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent contends the current administration ended the program because it questioned the cost and felt private companies could do the job better. He also says the tool wasn't used very much. Rubin notes private companies often promote free filing, but federal investigations show fewer than 3% of eligible taxpayers actually complete their returns without being upsold. And with many families already stretched thin, he says losing direct file leaves low-income filers with limited options.
Very low-income people have access to a program called VITA. VITA is chronically underfunded. It never has enough money and enough people to meet the demand that exists in local communities.
Supporters say canceling direct file also means higher costs for the federal government, which had been saving millions by shifting taxpayers from paper returns to electronic filing, reducing audit rates, and shrinking the number of calls coming into the IRS.
So all told, direct file was projected to achieve savings of $300 million across the IRS.
This story was based on original reporting by Josh Israel with the Michigan Independent. For the Michigan News Connection, I'm Crystal Blair.
President Trump urges Republicans to vote for Epstein documents to be released. Finger pointing over the government shutdown continues, and federal cuts impact the youth mental health crisis. With that story and more, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Donald Trump appears to have chickened out on the Epstein scandal. He's caved. It's a complete and total surrender.
House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries says President Donald Trump has stopped hiding his connections to dead billionaire sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein. The president has changed position to urge House Republicans to vote today to force the Justice Department to release all documents relating to its investigation of Epstein, calling the scandal a Democrat hoax. Democrats say Trump could release the files anytime he wants, and note he just ordered the Attorney General to investigate Epstein's connection to his political enemies. In a surprise to many, Trump says he's negotiating with Democrats on direct payments to consumers to offset spiking health insurance premiums, a central issue in the government shutdown. Former Alabama Democratic Senator Doug Jones says the 8 Democratic senators who broke ranks to reopen the government shouldn't be attacked by progressives in the party who doubt the GOP's sincerity on the issue.
The biggest deficit we've got in Capitol Hill right now is one of trust. Democrats just didn't trust Republicans. Republicans don't trust Democrats. And I think that's why they held out for as long as they did.
Trump pushed Senate Republicans to end the filibuster to reopen the government by passing a budget stopgap with a simple majority. The party's leader refused to do that, and former Ohio Republican Congressman Steve Stivers points out that once the filibuster was removed from the confirmation process for judges, it never came back. He calls the so-called nuclear option a bad idea.
The Senate, even though it gets me frustrated in serving in the House, is supposed to be the saucer that cools the emotions. And so the filibuster rule, I think, is good for America. It does give the minority some power.
Food banks nationwide are still feeling the ripple effects of delayed USDA food assistance. Jason Aldrich with the West Ohio Food Bank says full SNAP benefits were just reauthorized in the state, and they're still scrambling to meet an exploding need.
Between September and October, we here at the food bank have seen an 11% increase in the number of folks seeking food assistance from us, and those numbers are staying up, if not getting higher.
The federal government is announcing the 2026 cost increases for Medicare and Medicaid. Medicare Part B will rise almost 10%, taking up the cost of living increase in next year's Social Security payments. Tatiana Fasiu is with the California Health Advocates Senior Medicare Patrol.
Not only do you have to think about your potential healthcare spending dollars for next year, but also how is that Social Security income going to offset increases in your Medicare costs?
Schools and providers say federal cuts are making it harder for them to deal with an ongoing youth mental health crisis. In Chicago, the nonprofit Juvenile Protective Association serves hundreds of mostly students with individual school-based programs, with 70% having Medicaid coverage. The association's Karen G. Foley says principals and educators were already stretching limited resources.
Then you layer on top food cuts, you layer on top of that ICE rage, you layer on top of that the news cycle and social media, and I give kids enormous credit for even showing up and trying.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after the newscast for Coast Range Radio. Host Michael Gaskell interviews the mayor of Newport, Oregon, on the city's pushback against a possible ICE facility in their town. At 6, it's Transpositive PDX, then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with an overnight low of 38 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy with a daytime high of 53. Today in history, in 1993, 21 political parties in South Africa approve a new constitution expanding voting rights and ending white minority rule. The quote of the day is from Canadian novelist Margaret Atwood. Born this day in 1939, she said, quote, "The fabric of democracy is always fragile everywhere because it depends on the will of citizens to protect it. And when they become scared, when it becomes dangerous for them to defend it, it can go very quickly."
Tribes push back on a Trump plan to allow private hydropower project permits on reservations. With that story and more, it's Brian Bull with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. Last week, more than a dozen tribes commented on a proposal by the Trump administration to let developers obtain preliminary permits for hydropower projects on reservations in spite of tribal opposition. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio has more.
This new rule would apply to projects like dams, reservoirs, and pump storage facilities, all overseen by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which, under a Biden-era rule, does not issue such permits without consent. That independent agency is now being asked to change course by Energy Secretary Chris Wright.
He put tribes in the same sentence as third parties. And what that tells me is that there's that lack of respect.
Stuart Koyaemtiwa is the Hopi Tribal Historic Preservation Officer and commented on behalf of his tribe. As for their neighbors in northern Arizona, the Navajo Nation thinks dialogues with future developers have improved.
What we've seen is contrary to, I think, what was included in the letter for the request for rulemaking from the secretary, that the policy has not, in fact, hindered development on the nation.
Navajo Acting Assistant Attorney General Erica Perot, who penned their brief, wants an extension. Tribes had only 17 days to reply while dealing with the longest U.S. government shutdown.
We received notice of this October 27th. It's been a pretty tight turnaround.
For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
Young Native people from across the country are gathered in Seattle this week, developing their leadership skills and discussing tribal issues, including sovereignty and policymaking. They're taking part in the National Congress of American Indians Youth Convention, which is being held alongside NCII's annual convention. Shania Wachinio is an 8th grade student from the Saboba Band in Southern California.
I'm with Tana program from Saboba, and just going to the conferences to learn new things. Learning other Native American tribes, their traditions, and what other people, like their stories and everything.
Crystal Williams, vice chair of the Coushatta tribe of Louisiana, says it's important to have young people be part of NCAI's gathering.
To me, it's very important as a tribal leader. I've been in this for a decade now, and it's so important for me to make sure that our youth know about leadership, how to run tribes, because they will be, you know, the ones that are going to be handling this here in the next 10, 20, 30 years. So I am an advocate for youth, in leadership. So I feel like we have the responsibility to teach them as much as we can.
161 young people ages 14 to 24 are attending the youth convention. They're also encouraged to attend the main NCAI general sessions and meetings to hear from tribal leaders from across Indian country. Both events run through Friday. And on this day in 1895, the Nez Perce Indian Reservation in Idaho was opened up to white settlers. After encroachment, war, and a gold rush compromised the previous treaty's defined boundaries, prevailing white sentiment deemed the unfarmed and undeveloped areas as surplus, leading to the further breaking up of lands held by the Namipu. And it's also the birthday of Wilma Mankiller, born in 1945. She became the first woman to be elected principal chief of the Cherokee Nation. A lifelong advocate of Native and women's rights, Mankiller said she was largely inspired by the 1969 occupation of Alcatraz by indigenous activists. She died in 2010 with friend and feminist icon Gloria Steinem by her side. This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull.
So, which yeasty snack is better, Marmite or Vegemite? You might not care or even know what the heck I'm talking about, but the Brits and the Aussies certainly do, and the rivalry has been exploited by the manufacturers of both over the years. Now, a prisoner in Australia is suing over a regional prohibition over Vegemite, and victims' rights advocates don't find the lawsuit funny or entertaining. KBOO's Josh Salem tells us more.
Marmite and Vegemite are both spreads made from brewer's yeast and are often used in place of butter on toast. Neither are usually part of the typical American's cuisine, but they are popular in Commonwealth countries, with fierce mock battles raging over the years as to which is tastier. In Australia, more than 80% of households are estimated to have a jar of Vegemite in the pantry, but that's not true of all of its correctional facilities. In fact, the inmates in all 12 prisons in Victoria have been going without. Now, a prisoner is challenging a state ban on prisoners eating Vegemite, claiming withholding the yeast-based spread breaches his human right to, quote, enjoy his culture as an Australian, end quote. Andre McKechnie, 54, serving a life sentence for murder, brought the fight to Victorian Supreme Court today. He is suing Victoria's Department of Justice and Community Safety, in the agency that manages the prisons, Corrections Victoria. Vegemite has been banned from Victorian prisons since 2006, with Corrections Victoria saying it interferes with dogs that sniff out narcotics. Inmates allegedly used to smear packages of illicit drugs with Vegemite in the hope that the odor would distract the dogs. Vegemite also contains yeast, which is banned from Victorian prisons because of its theoretical potential to be used in the production of alcohol. That latter use was previously denied by Vegemite's U.S. owner because the manufacturing process kills the yeast. McKechnie is seeking a court declaration that the defendants denied him his rights under the Charter of Human Rights and Responsibilities Act. The act guarantees all persons with a particular cultural, religious, racial, or linguistic background the right to enjoy their culture, to declare and practice their religion, and to use their language. He also wants a declaration that the defendants breached the Corrections Act by failing to provide food adequate to maintain his well-being. Vegemite has been manufactured in Australia since 1923 as an alternative to Britain's Marmite. The spread is beloved by a majority of Australians, but is typically considered an acquired taste. The last U.S. president to visit Australia, Barack Obama, once said, quote, "It's horrible," end quote. It's a favorite on breakfast toast and in cheese sandwiches, and Australian travelers are frequently said to bemoan its scarcity overseas. Prisons in Queensland also ban Vegemite, but Australia's most populous state, New South Wales, does not. John Herron, a victims of crime advocate and lawyer, says this is a frivolous lawsuit that is offensive to victims' families. Herron said, quote, "As victims, we don't have any rights. We have limited, if any, support. It's always about the perpetrator, and this just reinforces that. It's an extra perk that is rubbing our faces in the tragedy that we've suffered," end quote. McEchnie is currently held in a maximum security prison. He was sentenced to life for murder and spent 8 years out on parole in Victoria before he decided the system, quote, "had done more damage than good," opting to return to prison. The case is scheduled for trial next year. His lawyers did not respond to a request for comment. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Now we go to Global Citizen Commentary from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. He says the 1997 movie Wag the Dog may have new relevance as President Trump considers his options with Venezuela. As in the movie, Trump faces multiple major domestic problems. Going to war with another country may look like a very attractive distraction. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. Remember the 1997 movie Wag the Dog, which starred Robert De Niro as a spin doctor for a president mired in a sex scandal? De Niro's solution was to create a distraction, a war with Albania. Now, as President Trump considers what to do with his Caribbean armada and Venezuela's narco-terrorist leader, Nicolas Maduro, we may be witness to another Wag the Dog event, U.S. military pressure and possibly a direct attack on Venezuela. The case for Trump to be highly motivated to act out of self-interest is strong. Consider this. First, his approval ratings are very low and declining by the week, around 36% of overall approval, with even lower ratings on his handling of the economy, tariffs, and the government shutdown. Second, his economic policies have led to food and healthcare inflation, declining consumer confidence, a very large population living from paycheck to paycheck, and considerable grumbling among corporate leaders. Trump is now flailing about for a response, such as $2,000 direct payments to families and lower tariffs on food imports, things that will assuage people's growing anger. It's desperation time. Third, the Epstein case is about to explode in Trump's face. Republicans are defecting in droves on a vote to demand the release of all government files on Epstein. It is already clear that Trump, Attorney General Pam Bondi, and others in Trump's circle have lied about the Trump-Epstein relationship. Trump's order to Bondi to prosecute his political enemies and investigate Democrats who knew Epstein will probably do little to displace the Trump-Epstein story. Next, the stark corruption in and around the White House is a sharp contrast with rising economic inequality. Trump's cryptocurrency ventures, the East Wing demolition, the glitzy White House parties, the Argentina bailout, the Middle East hotel projects, these are all, as Robert De Niro would have said, bad optics. Next, a blue tide is emerging. The Democrats are getting traction on Epstein, affordability, and incompetence in Trump's cabinet. 2026 doesn't look promising for Republicans. And last, judges around the country are ruling against National Guard deployments to cities and brutal ICE tactics against immigrants and citizens. As Trump looks around for an off-ramp, preparing to attack Venezuela surely has come to mind. After all, he and Pete Hegseth have assembled an enormous force in the Caribbean that goes far beyond any counter-drug operation. Hegseth has reinforced the mission's importance by giving it a name, Operation Southern Spear. What better way to showcase the war on drugs than to use all that firepower and score a dramatic win against a second-rate Venezuelan army? Trump has also lined up the legal argument, thanks to Bondi. As the New York Times has reported, the Justice Department's legal counsel has given Trump precisely the justification he cites for attacking alleged drug boats, namely that the U.S. is engaged in armed conflict against the drug cartels and narco-terrorism. By that argument, taking the fight to its source must also be legal. And since the president has made a determination as to the national security implications, presumably there is no need to consult with or obtain the consent of Congress. Trump's way of dealing with foreign affairs further lends itself to the wag-the-dog possibility. Self-interest comes first, the consequences of aggressive actions last. What to do about Venezuela is above all a personal issue, just as the Gaza peace plan, the war in Ukraine, and the 8 other wars Trump has resolved are personal triumphs. He may pretend to be consulting with military leaders about options in Venezuela, but does he really care what they say? They are interested in strategy and the national interest, not in protecting him and his regime. Only Trump can protect Trump. To be clear, wag-the-dog explanations are alluring but rarely persuasive. It is all too easy to assign domestic troubles as the reason for a foreign adventure, since all countries have economic, political, or social problems at a given moment. Authoritarian rule in Venezuela provides a convenient, well-used pretext for U.S. action. Maduro's regime is illegitimate. Venezuela's oil wealth can be taken. Drug cartels in Mexico, Colombia, and elsewhere can be put on notice. Yet in this instance, wag the dog can't be dismissed. Not that Trump had the idea of invading Venezuela as a diversion all along. It may only have occurred to him in the last few days as bad news piled up and began to seem insurmountable. We can speculate that the failure to bury the Epstein files is a tipping point. I've got to do something that takes attention away from those files, Trump may be thinking. Otherwise, the 2026 elections are lost, not to mention my presidency. If nothing else, this might be a good time to take another look at Wag the Dog. Its relevance never seems to end. I'm Mil Gertov for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, November 18th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with breaking news, stories, or tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem and Mel Gertov. The producer and engineer is Althea Billings. Special thanks to Isabel Charlet, Brian Bull, Edwin J. Vieira, and Crystal Blair. The director of the Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast for the newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Danny Shy.
And I'm Dave Johnson. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44322.